I don't know that I could tell the difference between the various mints.
Really?
Peppermint, spearmint.
Yeah.
Winter mint is the one that like goes for it. It's icy.
Oh, I see.
Whereas spearmint's a little herbier, I would say.
Well, we should have a mint tasting.
Gum tasting on the podcast. That would be great for listeners. Like... Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. Happy holidays, everyone. We pre-recorded this episode, so if something crazy has happened in the politics world in the meantime, our apologies, we're not going to talk about it.
We can edit it in.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe that did that. Wow.
No, can you believe that, though? Really? I mean, we live in a world where it seems like there are a lot of unbelievable things that happen, but right. That thing that just happened.
I mean, it should just be, I can't believe they indicted, insert name. All right. Today, though, is a bit away from the news, and it's going to be, we're going to have a little year-end fun. So we're going to have what we are calling our end-of-year award ceremony. We're going to take stock of the year, handing out superlative awards. This is like the world's wonkiest yearbook possible. We're going to go through some categories like worst politicking or best data set of 2018. Here to do that, the usual panel, Nate Silver, back.
Hey, back from Japan.
Hello.
Welcome. Back in body. In spirit, I don't know. In
really?
Spirit, it's like midnight. Uh-huh. I'm just getting to bed after having some amazing food, you know, and a whatever fancy whiskey they have, you know. So it's in spirit. I'm not necessarily fully here, but like I'm going to give it my best effort.
Well, I really appreciate that. You clearly missed the black tie only on the invitation for this award ceremony, but that's okay.
Okay.
We're all here.
Yeah.
Yes. Claire Malone, politics writer, is here. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hello.
And then later in the show, after we do our awards, we're going to do something that we've done a few times now around the new year, which is share our resolutions for the coming new year. These are like personal, professional, journalistic resolutions. We will get to that. But first, let's get right into our award ceremony. Here's how we're going to do it. I will name a category, read some nominations, then each of you can jump in and advocate for ones. We can debate them. You can add new nominations if you'd like, and then we'll try and maybe come to a consensus about who wins the award. Micah did a really good job yesterday. In this timeline, 8 days ago, of posting on Twitter and asking for some suggestions. So thanks to everyone who suggested on Twitter, and we're going to fold some of those in. Here we go. The first category is the most important demographic trend that was highlighted in 2018. So most important demographic trend from 2018. I'll rattle off some of the nominations and we can discuss urban versus rural partisanship, the gender gap, the suburbs shifting left, the education gap, and youth turnout.
My vote, I think, would be for the education gap.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument for that is we saw a big education gap in 2016. There was some question, I think, about how much of that was Trump-specific. And yet we saw it again in 2018, maybe even heightened in certain cases, without Trump on the ballot. So to me, it's confirmation of this new world in which education is a bigger dividing line between the parties than it used to be.
Claire, any thoughts?
Well, not to be the stereotype as the only woman on the podcast, but I'm going to go with the gender gap. It's a trend that we saw start many years ago, but certainly widened quite a bit in 2016. And I think if we're talking about activists, especially on the Democratic side, who in a midterm year were very active and an interesting story, it was women. And in general, I think that will be, you know, continue to become a shift in American politics, college-educated white women as a group that increasingly is becoming more Democratic. And there was a couple-point shift on non-college-educated white women more towards the Democrats. Obviously, still more pro-Republican, but I think there's some interesting stuff going on with women in America and politics.
Nate, do you have one of these that you want to weigh in on? Or
yeah, the correct answer is F,
yeah.
A new one, which was the extremely high turnout across the board in 2018.
It's not a demographic trend.
It is not.
Okay.
Welcome back from vacation, Nate.
Wow.
Read the directions.
It's jet lagged.
I mean, I'll go with urban versus rural.
Oh, okay. So now all three of you have selected a different one. Thank you, Nate, for finally getting there to a different point.
All right, let's just move on to question number two.
Well, wait, no. Let me ask a question about the gender gap and then in particular the education gap. Because anecdotally, it feels like we spent much of the first half of 2018 talking about year of the woman, year of the woman. The gender gap is huge, is huge. And I do think that after the election, we spent just on this podcast as the sample size, a little more talking about the education gap. I don't know if you agree or disagree, but
maybe
like,
that's our internal bias.
Right. So yeah, I guess what's going on there, Micah? Do you feel like this didn't land as the year of the woman in the way that maybe we were anticipating, or did something catch us off guard?
Yeah, Micah, why do you hate women?
Yeah, that's the question.
And their year.
I think it's accurate to say we spent more time talking about the education than the gender gap, but I don't think we spent more time talking about education than women, which is to say...
We talked a lot about college-educated white women.
So right. So it overlaps, one. But two, and we'll get to this in the storyline thing, but I do think Year of the Woman held up with the election results, but that includes candidates, right? Who won, who ran, and who won, which I do think is one of the biggest stories of 2018. But, you know, I read the category correctly and was limiting myself.
So let's talk about this in a more interesting way, which is I think that American politics now pays more attention to the lives and concerns of women. And I don't mean that in a rah-rah gender way. But I mean in the past, you know, 3 years, particularly since Trump, because of sort of the extreme sexist stuff going on, there's just been a lot more writing about women, not from a, like, having it all standpoint, but about sort of some of the society-wide grievance points. And I think we all kind of know that anger is a very motivating feeling in politics. And so, you know, and this has been written about a lot. You know, Rebecca Traister writes about women's anger. Claire Massoud, one of my favorite novelists, wrote about women's anger in a wonderful way in The Woman Upstairs a few years ago. But whatever, it's this society-wide grievance from one gender that's spun into our politics in this way that I think is really interesting. And I think it's has manifested itself first in, as Micah was saying, college-educated white women, in part because they probably are paying more attention to politics and to what's happening in the world. But I just think it's a really interesting, perceptible, in my book, shift over the past 3 years, compounded in this midterm election because it is the first election that we've had since Trump. And Trump, you know, started a new angrier women's movement in some ways.
All right. So for the sake of moving on and just landing on a winner here, I'm going to say that gender gap wins the award for most important demographic trend highlighted by 2018. Let's move on to our next category. Best politicking of 2018. And we can discuss what the word politicking means. I don't think we use it that much on this podcast. But our nominees are Beto O'Rourke, Brian Kemp, Amy Klobuchar, the GOP shepherding the Kavanaugh nomination, getting their guy, and the Zuckerberg, this is on the list, the Zuckerberg Senate testimony. Some of these came in on Twitter, some of these were a little cheeky, but those are our starting group of nominees. We can also throw in other ones if we want. Nate, do you have some thoughts here? I'm sure you do.
I think some of these are closer to worst than best. I mean, I think Facebook, although Zuckerberg's testimony is one of the more effective moments, I think Facebook had a disastrous year. I think that it's questionable whether the GOP helped itself at all with the Kavanaugh hearing. Amy Klobuchar had one nice round of questioning. Beto did do fine, but he lost. I don't think it's an award-type season. And Brian Kemp won by less than a Republican typically would in Georgia. I mean, you know, I don't know who the best politicking would go to.
Let's get a definition.
Maybe Rick Scott in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a race where Republicans did not win very many swing races, and he beat an incumbent in a race that's going to have a lot of effect going forward.
Can I ask a question? Do you justify, you're kind of going here, you sort of have to have won an election in order to be considered for best politics?
I'm saying best. I mean, it's not the sabermetric version of, you know.
Right.
But even in a sabermetric sense, I mean, it was a really blue year, and Florida's a purple state, maybe a little bit red tinge, but to beat a Democratic incumbent in a blue year in a purple state, granted, Bill Nelson had some problems. Granted, that race was close and may have been different if you didn't have this badly designed ballot in one county. But like, but still, Rick Scott has won under difficult circumstances several times, and it's a consequential win.
I mean, a different one. Joe Manchin.
Mm-hmm.
Quiet politicking, but he, particularly when it comes to that Kavanaugh vote, which was, I think, my favorite naked display of just like opportunism, which is the moment that Susan Collins decided that she was going to vote for Kavanaugh.
She's on our list for later.
Joe Manchin was like, me too. But like going back, I just think like you can look at this Democrat who's just, and I think it's accumulated over many years, but like Joe Manchin is just the last man standing. And it's in part because of decisions like the one he made over Kavanaugh, you know? I don't know. It's not quite politicking in the classic sense. I think you could put someone like Ocasio-Cortez up there who, you know, had a an incumbent that was ripe for picking off, but who, if we're expanding the definition of politicking to expanding your reputation and building a brand, as much as I hate that term, she's done that. That has become like a high profile thing in 2018 in a way it wasn't in 2017 or 2016.
And Ocasio-Cortez is on our list for a category down the line. But I do like this. I think they're maybe both stronger than the original crop. But Micah, do you have any to add, or do you want to argue for another one, or do you want to cast a winning vote for either of the two that we just heard?
Well, I was actually going to suggest Ocasio-Cortez. But let me make an argument for Beto real quick.
Uh-huh.
Sure, he lost.
Is this Pod Save America?
But this is... Being 538, we don't simply just look at wins and losses. We look at how people performed relative to expectations and relative to how they should have done. And if you're just looking at, you know, how Beto started the year versus how he finished the year, he is now, you would have to say it's very early, but he's one of the favorites to win the 2020 Democratic nomination. That's a pretty freaking good 2018, right? Mm-hmm. To basically come from nowhere to now you're one of four or five people who is in that top tier.
He's like the Cardi B of politics. Just come out of nowhere.
This is where I pretend to know who that is.
Really?
But,
do you know who Offset is?
So I think he's a very good choice. Ocasio-Cortez like ousted what everyone thought was a very safe incumbent representative. Now has a national profile to some extent, is an up-and-comer in the Democratic Party.
I mean, that's really impressive. Yeah. She came from someone who did not have any official position in politics
at all. No political experience, yeah.
Had been, I think, a server at a restaurant a year ago, right? And now is one of the biggest rising stars in the Democratic Party and beat an incumbent. I mean, that's really impressive, and that shows a lot of talent.
She is part of our most surprising result category, I think, coming on. So for the sake of mixing it up, not that people can't win twice, but for the sake of mixing it up, let's go with Joe Manchin and Rick Scott as our two finalists for this and take quick votes and see if we can't award this for best politicking of 2018.
Wait a second. Why can't you win in two categories?
She can win in two categories? I don't know. Just trying to spread the love. People care about this stuff. They're going to make plaques and put it up on the wall. I want as many people as possible to get an award from 538.
People don't get participation awards in this.
Rick Scott, Joe Manchin, Ocasio-Cortez. Claire?
I'm going to go with Joe Manchin, just to mix it
Rick
up.
Rick Scott.
Oh, thanks, guys. Okay.
No, you break the tie, Jerry.
Okay, I'm going to break the tie. Well, as you know, that I don't think people should win twice, and AOC may win later down the line. So I'm going to go with Joe Manchin.
It's bullshit. Even though I'm in my category, the bullshit reason.
No, I actually think Joe Manchin's a very smart one, and I think maybe overlooked as a really impressive moment from this campaign. Okay, let's move on to worst politicking of 2018. So here are a bunch of nominees. Trump and immigration leading up to the midterms, so all the tweeting and stuff about the caravan. The DACA shutdown. Cory Booker's This Is My Spartacus moment. Everyone remember that?
No.
Exactly. the tax bill. Avenatti. Just blanket Avenatti.
That's the winner.
His existence.
And then the day Sam Nunberg went on an unhinged tour of every cable news show ever. And I don't know if that was politicking, but
I think that was a mental break.
That was just something else.
Again.
The worst politicking. But Nate wants to add something else.
Yeah. So some of the other options listed here in our prep document.
Uh-huh.
The Elizabeth Warren DNA test, I think, actually deserves consideration here.
But does that count as politicking?
Yeah.
As a political move, she took that test and...
Look, I mean, all you can say is, like, Elizabeth Warren's numbers are extremely flat for someone who was seemingly pretty well liked by Democrats a year ago. And I don't want to, like, rely too much on, like, oh, when I'm having a conversation over coffee with someone. But this is the first thing that comes up whenever I talk to anyone about Elizabeth Warren. It's like, oh, she bungled that DNA test. And that's not just among, like, inside. Are you rolling your eyes, Micah?
No, I'm not rolling my eyes at you. That this is a thing I find
very
ridiculous.
Early.
It's very reminiscent to me of the criticism Hillary Clinton got for the email stuff.
I tweeted that. And it probably is because there are other reasons why people resist Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
And some of those have to do with her age and her gender and so forth.
And her race. I think you're getting a lot of pushback. When you're getting feedback about, oh, I don't know about Elizabeth Warren anymore, I think it largely comes from probably younger people in the party, maybe people of color, who say, whoa, this is kind of demonstrates a lack of facility with certain racial concepts, and do we want someone like that? And I do think a lot of it has to do with age and race. But I also think at the same time, it's December 2018. There's a while to go. To Micah's point, is this just being played up because she's a woman and people are looking for a reason that's more palatable than, like, her voice annoys me or she reminds me of my school teacher? And, like, I thought it was a bit premature for the Boston Globe editorial page to be like, she missed her moment. She should drop out of the race she's not technically in.
I'm just saying,
yet.
Like, I think that deserves to be on the list because I think that's one that, for rightly or wrongly, will have or has had some consequences. Although I think the real winner, in my view, is Michael Avenatti.
Yeah, I knew it.
No, that is
general,
the winner.
But Michael Avenatti in particular on the Kavanaugh stuff and with this third accuser, because it really is. So I am, like, more sympathetic to actions that were undertaken that people thought would be good politics and didn't turn out that way versus things where you knew it was a disaster from the start, right?
But you don't think Avenatti thought he had a moment and he had enough.
I think the fact that any Democrat listened to Michael Avenatti was idiotic for doing so and should have known better. So first of all, this accuser has a very wild story that doesn't really directly involve Kavanaugh at all. She has a lot of credibility problems, and he puts her out there and overpromises in terms of, like, oh, there are going to be other witnesses that come forward and whatever else, right? And so I think he was very harmful to this woman. I think he was very harmful to women who correctly accuse men of sexual assault or sexual harassment. I think he was extremely damaging to Democrats' hopes to prevent Kavanaugh from being nominated. And I think he all did it for vainglorious reasons because he's an egomaniac and has terrible judgment. And so I think this is a complete disaster. I think he'd be on the list of, like, in a decade's worth of bad politics. I think Avenatti's handling of the Kavanaugh thing would be on that list.
Wait,
not the winner.
Nate, can you tell us how you really feel?
Yeah.
Mike, you want to jump in on this and then we'll offer the award.
So I do want to put one shout out to Cory Booker's Spartacus moment.
Can you remind us?
I really don't.
It was just generally his performance during the Kavanaugh stuff. Just, you know, it was not great. It was
his grandstanding stuff.
Yeah, when he said that he had asked
for
a document to be released,
right,
even though it was illegal, but then it turned out it may not have actually been illegal, and it was a clear sort of grandstanding.
But the thing is, that's so run of the mill in politics.
Right. That's why. No, and that's why I don't think it should win.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to be that damaged. I mean,
no, he's fine. And then the Warren thing, I'm not even saying that the way she handled that she handled it well. She didn't handle it well. I just think so much of the criticism, this, like, stage direction criticism where the criticism is about the politics of it. It's like, oh, she mishandled the politics of this rather than, oh, she did something wrong on the substance here and therefore the politics are bad. I just find it all stupid. And so, yeah, I think of Avenatti as the winner here.
So we'll maybe slightly expand this category to be like biggest political misstep of 2018. And then I think we can agree that we're awarding it to Michael Avenatti. Everyone on board with that? It's the first true consensus award.
Yeah.
Congratulations, buddy. Okay. We're going to move on. We're going to mix it up in a little bit.
I hope he tweets it, Nate.
He will.
We're going to move on. We're going to mix it up a little bit with the next category. But first, let's take a quick break. And I'll tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. Many people want to give to good charities, especially towards the end of the year. The clock is ticking, but you can still give to a good charity. But how will you maximize the good that you accomplish for each dollar that you give? Well, GiveWell goes in depth and does detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. On its website, givewell.org, you can see a very short list of charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. GiveWell is unique because it focuses on how much good a charity accomplishes. For instance, how many lives does it save, or how much does someone's income increase with each dollar donated? Instead of easier to answer but less important questions that maybe some other places use, things like how much does a charity's CEO make or how much overhead does it have? The current top charities at GiveWell do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria or provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. Go to GiveWell.org right now. Make the most of your giving. It takes 2 minutes. Once again, that's GiveWell.org. All right, we're back with our next award. We're going to mix it up a little bit, and we're going to award this to, listen to how magnanimous we're about to be, the best piece of non-538 data journalism. So I'm going to read off five pieces that we, I think, all were impressed by, and we'll talk about which ones we liked and which one we want to award this to. So there was the live polling project from the New York Times. We obviously talked about that on the podcast a fair amount. The New York Times reported, I think it was just this last couple of weeks, on location data sets being kind of even creepier than we thought. Facebook and other phones and so forth being able to track us kind of at a level that was previously unreported. Micah has mentioned this data set a fair amount, but The Economist did this thing about how to forecast an American's vote according to other predictors and demographics. There was a piece by our former colleague Allison McCann in the New York Times about how voting blocks have shifted from the 80s until now. I call this the little swingy chart piece, but it had all these very interesting demographic swings. And our final nominee is a piece in the Washington Post about navigating the border, which was this interactive that used maps to show just kind of what kind of barriers are along the border. So it showed where there's walls, where there's fences, where there's rivers and so forth. But it really just kind of did a nice job painting a picture and giving a sense of what the actual physical border between the U.S. and Mexico looks like. So those are our nominees. Nate is the most magnanimous in our group. Do you want to start here and say which one should win?
Live polling. There should only have been one nomination, and it should have been live polling. I mean, not because of the live aspect of it, which was cool, but because, like, of the transparency it creates, number
it's
one.
It's cool to live in these hierarchies.
And because the polling was really freaking good. Their polling was extremely accurate. We haven't run the pollster ratings yet, but I'm sure based on preliminary work that we know others have done that it will get a very, very good score going into House districts that often don't get a lot of nonpartisan polling. So I thought that was, you know, again, a
Can I ask you a question?
Decadal, not just an annual nomination.
Can I ask you a question about that? We get the question, I think, a fair amount at 538. Why don't we conduct polls? And I think we have a pretty standard answer to that. But was there any part of you that just sort of was like, should a journalistic enterprise take this step as the Times did? Did any of that give you pause?
I mean, I think there's a little bit of unkosherness because if you're doing a forecast that uses polling inputs and you create your own polls, it's a little bit weird maybe, you know. But they also didn't issue their forecast. And it's a bit like also, you know, obviously one, I think, more selfish reason that we like this is because it's not overlapping with what we do, right? And I don't see the reason why. I mean, there is some value in having multiple models because every model has different assumptions and bugs and so forth, right? But like, to be really super honest, they had a model that was very, very much like the 538 model. And so I'm not sure that it had that much distinctiveness, whereas these polls really do. I mean, they're polling races that were not polled in ways that hadn't been done before and in ways that were like extremely accurate.
Claire?
So, you know, my dad often repeats this phrase, de gustibus non est disputandum, which means in matters of taste, there can be no dispute, right? Which I think is sometimes an unpopular thing with Nate Silver, who has strict hierarchies.
It's almost as like nobody else can have an opinion of something.
How often does your dad repeat that phrase?
But I think that the New York Times reporting on location databases and data sets and how much private companies are tracking us was probably some of the best use of data that I've seen. And for two reasons. One, I think it was a scoop, an important scoop that I think could have only really been, the impact of that reporting could have only really been shown in the way that the Times visualized it. And like here, I would like to give a shout out to my friend Michael Keller, who was on the reporting team and I think did a really good job. But that bias aside, I think it's important that live polling was really interesting. And I think, you know, horse race stuff is obviously part of our bread and butter. But I think that data journalism and data reporting being made pertinent and made important to people who might not be interested in very niche parts of politics or polling, you know, I think it's important to expand out the genre. And to me, the Times story really did that, and it did it well, and showed the very real kind of changes in our privacy contract, societal contract, that have been made over the past, you know, 10 or 15 years.
I agree with all that. Let me throw two things on there that weren't on the list. I love the live polling thing, and I think Claire's probably right about the winner. But one shout out to the Washington Post. America is more diverse than ever, but still segregated. Had these like beautiful, beautiful maps showing how segregated we are by race.
Well, I'm looking at them on your screen. I hadn't seen these before. They're like hypercolor, psychedelic.
They're super cool. And just like drive. I think people, or a lot of people, know that we're still segregated. But you look at these maps and you're just like, oh man, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty stunning. The other one I would just put a shout out for, which I think scoops another category a little bit, but the Washington Post has been tracking Trump lies. And I think, to a large extent, you know, lying and falsehoods has been like the defining feature of the Trump administration relative to other presidencies.
Does this count as data journalism? I mean, is the lying a data set?
Yes, I think so, in the sense that, one, they made a data set of it. And two, I think tracking it in the way they have has lent scale and context to the extent of Trump's lying in a way that I don't think you would have otherwise. You know, they've tracking the way they have, they've been able to say, like, you know, at one point Trump had averaged 5 false claims a day, which is stunning and amazing. And you know, I think Trump recently topped like 5,000. Anyway, I just thought it's not the most like complicated analysis in the world, but I thought it was just a really good way to capture mm-hmm. what has been like a defining feature of this administration.
Okay, so we're not going to give out an award here. That would be the non-magnanimous thing to do. Should we just say everyone's a winner?
Dibus.
Exactly. See that thing that Claire's dad said. But one thing maybe we can do, Micah, can we tweet out from the 538 Politics account like links to all these and just shout sure. them out so people can see them if they want, because they are some great work, and then you can also nominate your others as well. But let's move on to our next category, and this one we will try and land on a winner on. The most important 2018 storyline for the 2020 Democratic primary. So stuff that happened this year that's going to have an impact on the 2020 Democratic primary. Healthcare, the notion that policy does not matter, suburban voters and how to win them, and then old guard versus new guard. We've talked about this a fair amount, the different tiers and groupings in the Democratic primary, and in 2018, those starting to emerge. So, Claire, you want to jump in on what you think the most important 2018 storyline for the 2020 Democratic primary is?
I mean, I guess of these, I'll go with old guard versus new guard, in the sense that I think the Democratic, the likely 2020 candidates, have already signed on to what I would call new guard litmus tests. So single payer, universal job guarantee kind of stuff. But there is also these, you know, there are lingering dynamics within the party manifested by, I would say, candidates like probably Joe Biden, although he hasn't put out a lot of policy statements, or more, you know, moderate white guy, you know, maybe mayoral candidates from somewhere who will run as a bit more moderate, a bit less boundary pushing. And I think that in many ways, the primary will become about that, and candidates will differentiate themselves not just by policy, but also, you know, by identity as a woman or as a black woman or a black man, as a, you know, just a woman in general. And I just think that that's a bit of a more, it's not new in politics, but it'll be more emphatic mm-hmm. in the 2020 primary, especially because there are going to be a shit ton of candidates, and that's a technical term.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to find a way to disagree with Claire, but I think she's right.
Old guard versus new guard?
Just, I think one of the biggest fault lines in the 2020 primary is shaping up to be age and whether you belong.
Among the candidates.
Among the candidates, yeah.
But did 2018 do something to really kind of set that up?
It sort of manifested itself in 2018 in the sense that you saw sort of people rise to the top of the potential 2020 list, but also I think you saw a lot of activism voting wise and candidate wise among young Democrats, and so I think that part of the party feels, you know, energized and empowered heading into 2020, and not particularly in the mood to be like, well, okay, we should just do what our elders tell us.
Nate, disagree.
I agree.
Wait, can I nominate one thing that's not on this list and see if it trumps Trump's this old guard versus new guard, which is Donald Trump. I mean, should he be still, this is fairly obvious, but should Donald Trump still be the storyline that is still going to define American politics, including the 2020 Democratic primary?
To be honest, no, I don't think so. I think he's like,
he's, Trump is old news.
Well, I mean, you say that in a flip way, but in some ways he is, right? He is certainly present. I mean, he is, but he is also, I think, as we come into a Democratic primary, he is loud background music, but he is background music, and the investigations are background music to who the central question mark, which is who's going to be the person who eventually will run against Trump. And I think in the next year, that's going to become more and more the prevailing question, because I think, you know, who knows how well they'll do it. But Democrats talked a lot about how do we message against Trump while also not becoming, you know, just some, you know, running a candidate that's someone who's in relief to Trump, who is Trump is a sun and they are the moon, you know, a reflection of his light.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, in one sense, Trump is obviously the most important factor. On the other hand, though, I think kind of what Claire's getting at, or maybe not, but like the marginal effect. I mean, Trump's He's just there, right? Mm-hmm. He's just there. He's a very important part of the landscape. He is a landscape, but like, but you don't necessarily have a ton of choices if you're Democrats on how to navigate around Trump. And also, like, to some extent, because he is so central, when you have an opportunity to emphasize some other point, then maybe you don't want to emphasize Trump because he's already so baked in to the news cycle and voters' expectations about him are very set. And so it's more like he's like the climate instead of the weather, if you will.
I will say, you know, this category is for the 2020 Democratic primary. If it were the 2020 general election, I could make a good argument for health care.
Right.
Health care just popped up as such a big issue in 2018, and we just had that judge rule the whole ACA unconstitutional. It just feels like, given the polling, health care might be a big advantage for the Democratic nominee in 2020.
We're going to move on, but we are going to award that category the 2018 storyline that will have the biggest impact on the 2020 Democratic primary. It's going to be hard to fit that all on one plaque, but we will try to old guard versus new guard. Let's move on and do some stuff about President Trump. So first up is best storyline for President Trump. We're going to do worst storyline in a moment, but best storyline for President Trump in 2018. The nominations are North Korea, the economy, still doing pretty well, and the rise of socialism domestically in this country.
I missed that.
The rise of socialism.
I guess when I was in Japan, yeah. There was a socialist revolution that I didn't realize.
Here, let me try and frame how this is, but it certainly doesn't – I'm not defending that it's on this list. It wasn't the easiest list to make. But I think it's that, for instance, AOC is now a character who Trump and Republicans can rail against, and railing against socialism is a tried and true thing for Republicans over the last couple decades. And so now that there is some ascendancy within the Democratic Party of – socialists, as we've discussed on the show, it gives Trump a boogeyman and is in turn a storyline that benefits him. Is that a reasonable characterization of that?
Very
category?
Reasonable. The answer here and the winner is the economy.
Yeah.
Nate?
Except the economy is wobbly by some measures.
Right,
now.
But that's – yes, correct. But I think some of this is also
– backward looking.
Well, but we're talking about the storylines, right? Which is in many ways about the perception. And I think you've only started to see stuff – recently bubbling up, and I think for the bulk of 2018 Trump has been able to credibly say, look, the economy's doing well.
Yeah.
Something like North Korea, I think, is a double-edged sword for Trump, for reasons that whatever we don't have to get into, but the economy perception wise has been the one thing he can keep going back to.
Perception, and up until recently all the indicators were really good too. I mean, you can legitimately get into discussions about inequality and important parts of the economy that weren't great and haven't shown sign of improvement. But overall, a strong economy for most of 2018 has been sort of the chief Trump feather in his cap.
I thought
that Trump deserves a little bit more credit for North Korea than he probably gets. In the sense that maybe he kind of accidentally backed into a policy, or maybe he understands the impulses of authoritarian leaders or whatever.
Right, but
else,
also
right?
People, North Korea's not going very well, though.
Is it? Yeah, that's.
Maybe it started off well, but like this is, if we're going for the complete 2018 storyline, North Korea is quite uncertain.
I'm
now.
Just glad that he's.
There's not a nuclear war.
There's not a nuclear war.
Fair enough. Okay, so
the lowest of standards.
So just on pure vote, we have 2-1 economy. So economy wins as best storyline for President Trump. We will certainly see how that, if and how that changes.
We're
in
all still alive. That's a good storyline.
For your consideration, we're all still alive. North Korea.
Okay, worst storyline for President Trump. So on our list, I think a lot of these came from Twitter, but pre-existing conditions and the...
His conditions or...
the way that Republicans and Trump in particular handled healthcare as a talking point and pre-existing conditions in particular. Stormy Daniels... The child separation issue, and I guess we can also expand that to larger border fiascos, and the Russia investigation writ large. Is this a pretty obvious one?
I think I have a one that is my gut.
Yeah?
Which is child separation.
Interesting. That's interesting.
Oh,
that's
I would strongly disagree.
Because that's where my gut is, too.
Because the administration did have to walk back provisions of it. I understand that, like, the caravan eventually became a bit of a motivating issue. But the child separation policy was just unpopular.
Yeah.
And they did change it.
So, Nate, you're going to say Russia investigation?
I think the biggest issue is Trump's apparent inability to adapt to different circumstances and to adapt to the fact
that's not
that,
a choice.
It's not a worse
it could be a choice, but frame that as a storyline.
Trump,
that it's Democrats won 40 or 41 seats in the midterms, and it's because Trump is unpopular, and I don't think it sunk in with him.
Mm-hmm. So Trump is Trump, and he doesn't adjust. That's a storyline.
We'll learn. Well, maybe he will. Maybe that'll sound silly in 6 months. I don't know. Yeah, but like, I do think, you know,
it's kind of an existential one, though.
I think these things related to like immigration and race are often the things that like fall along existing boundary lines enough. And they did back down on a child separation, so it kind of fades from the news cycle a little bit. You know, Stormy Daniels, I'm not convinced that has that much of a political impact on him. You know, I think obviously the here's a storyline that could be damaging to Trump, related indirectly to some of these things, is like the staff turnover is problematic because, you know, there are many presidents who recovered from a bad midterm to win re-election, but like they probably, frankly, had better people advising them, and you could get into a vicious cycle where now Trump is seen as hard to work with, which I suppose he is. There is more risk and less reward as investigations bear down. Anyone who is his chief of staff probably bears some personal liability and has to like lawyer up as they're taking the job, and so that you could see things like kind of unraveling.
I agree that sort of the worst thing politically for Trump in 2018 is probably that Trumpism is not going over well in the U.S. He's unpopular. Republicans lost a bunch of seats in the midterms. So I agree with Nate on that front. I guess I would just say if we're looking for, in this category, a more discrete storyline, the child separation was, I think, so far in the Trump era, the most like unambiguously bad story for Trump, in just in terms of like there was no, or there was very little at least, sort of both sidesism. You know, Republicans didn't really defend it. The politics were horrible.
Okay, so take our approval ratings chart and show me where child separation was. If that was the worst story of the year, you would expect to have more impact, and you can't really see the impact.
Well, but
at
he
all.
Had a. But part of that is he. It was such a bad story for him, and the politics seemed so bad for him that he had to back down almost immediately. So I don't know if the polls necessarily had time to pick it up.
Okay. So are we going to
not everything?
You didn't even
polls,
make a choice.
Nate.
You just like threw out words, and no. We're like option X.
So are we going to be able to land on one here? Sounds like we're in slightly different places.
No, Mike and I agree on child separation.
Yeah, majority rules.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I think. I'll there you go. There's a high five. Authentic high five. I mean, I'll point out the Russia investigation feels like the obvious answer, but maybe not in 2018. Maybe it's
exactly,
2019
yeah.
is the big looming one.
But gotta
the,
wait
you know,
for
again,
the...
just for those of you listening, being like, but the 17 investigations that are happening right now.
Well, yes. The Stormy Daniels one is the one where he might have the most immediate legal liability.
Yeah, yeah.
So both.
2019 is the year for all of that. Okay, let's move on to another category here. Most surprising election result. So our nominees, and you can throw in others if you want. Mike Braun, Republican, defeating the Democratic incumbent for Indiana Senate. Ron DeSantis winning the Florida governor's race in a very tight race. A sort of grouping of three unexpected wins. So the Oklahoma 5th, New York 11th, and Ocasio-Cortez, here she is, reappearing. And then Doug Jones, which I guess technically happened at the very end of 2017, but we're going to put him into this year's nominations. So, Nate, you want to jump in on most surprising election result of 2018?
I know he's going to go.
I mean, what's surprising mean?
Is that where you knew he was going to go?
I mean,
most
what
unexpected,
is?
Most one that we didn't see coming. And
I mean, relative to the 538 forecast, I think it was Oklahoma 5 was the biggest upset.
Yeah, you really blew that.
But I don't really think that's like the highest impact upset.
Okay, so what would
I be? I have no idea why Doug Jones, which happened last year, is included in this category.
Because it happened last year? Because it wasn't quote-unquote surprising?
No, it was. Well, I mean, again, it's like surprising relative to what?
Yeah.
He was only a couple points behind in the polls, so it wasn't that surprising in that sense. But like the whole story arc of Republicans somehow allowing a Democrat, you know, frankly, a fairly liberal Democrat to win in Alabama by like making every mistake imaginable is a pretty remarkable storyline and had consequences in terms of there were times when they would rather have had one more Senate seat at various points. You know, Ocasio-Cortez, I do dislike a little bit the notion of like, oh, okay, well, no one would have expected this to come in a primary. I mean, you expect out of 435 congressional districts there to be a couple of surprises. And so it's a little bit like, okay, but still, as someone who I think represents the emergence of a new kind of intersectional Democrat, if you will, and the fact that, like, this still seems underrated to me as a factor in 2020, the fact that if you have a candidate who maybe because she is black or Latina has credibility with minorities and then also captures people who are millennials and captures the left, you know, that's a really powerful coalition and, frankly, a more powerful coalition than when you're an old white socialist or something who tries to then capture other groups.
Is there a pick in here somewhere?
AOC.
Well, I guess AOC. Okay. I guess that if because if you're grouping all those together, which is kind of cheating, I'll take the value pack. And then I put a little bit of a word in for Ron DeSantis in terms of being not a huge upset, but the biggest poll-defying race, not by much, but by some, that really has a big impact. That was a big save for Republicans.
Claire?
I'll go with Ron DeSantis just because I think it was surprising to me when he won the primary, just as like an example of someone who was very Trumpy. And I would say, if I'm being honest with election night returns, I was most surprised by the Florida general. I just thought Gillum was going to win. And I don't really have a feeling. I don't know why, because obviously the state ended up swinging Republican. But I just think it was, to me, Gillum was such a surprising win in the primary as well, but seemed like more of a normal candidate in many ways. Like, you know, he wasn't politics before. Like, you know, so I think, you know, in general, I just continue to be surprised by Florida. A state which I love, but am perplexed by its politics.
Sometimes love can be very perplexing.
Why do you love Florida?
I mean, I like the beach, but I also just like that Florida is... Florida reminds me of, like, my childhood in the sense of, like, everything in Florida is kind of like the late 80s, early 90s. And it's kind of kitschy and fun. And and Central Florida smells like oranges, which is delightful. And I don't know. I just like it.
I don't like Florida. It's almost as bad as North Dakota in my book.
Oh, wow. You're really racking up the beef with different states here. Yeah. Micah, do you have a nomination here? And then we'll award.
I am torn between Nate and Claire's answer.
So
DeSantis
and
AOC, I think, are the top two. I will go with DeSantis.
All right. There it is. Ron DeSantis, you win 538's year-end superlative for most surprising election
results. So you held out AOC earlier, and now she doesn't win.
The breaks.
She doesn't win.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, but she did. We did give it to her earlier.
No,
we?
Jody resisted because he was so convinced.
I resisted, and then I got bullied into awarding it to her, I think. Okay.
Well, I would have heard twice, so fair enough.
Okay, we're going to end on this one, which is best random data point of 2018. We compiled a few random data points that are interesting or weird or whatever. So the first one is, we've talked about this a little bit on the show, our friend Dave Wasserman has a stat about Whole Foods being in districts that swung towards Democrats. I think two-thirds of the districts that went from GOP to Dem had a Whole Foods in them. So I don't know, it feels like this is his beat now. He's on the Whole Foods beat. So Dave Wasserman's Whole Foods stats. Someone nominated this on Twitter as an interesting stat from 2018. The DeSantis voting rights ticket split. So there was an amendment to restore felon rights that passed. But then Ron DeSantis, the Republican, as we've discussed, won the governor's race. So there was an interesting kind of left-leaning and right-leaning split there on the same ballot. And then turnout in 2018 being really high. It was a 50-year high, 49.3% of eligible voters turned out in this midterm, which is much higher than is usually the case in midterms.
So those are three. Date, and it's like 50 now.
What's that?
I heard 50.1.
Oh, really?
Saw that on Twitter.com. Someone.
Okay, so above 50, that's huge.
Notable, so, reliable source, Twitter.com.
Well, where do you think I got that? It's all on Twitter.com. So what is our award for best interesting data point of 2018? Micah, why don't you jump in?
The answer is turnout.
Turnout.
Yes. Okay. That's the most important data point of 2018. I think Nate got it this earlier. You know, if you do best random data point, I think it's Wasserman's Whole Foods thing.
See, I don't think that's a random thing. I think the Wasserman Whole Foods point, let's go beyond,
is fundamental.
Is about class in America,
yeah,
and about the ways that we've separated out ourselves to the point where if you're upper middle class or rich, you eat different things than someone who's middle class or lower middle class or poor. And I think that goes to a lot of fundamental ways that people in different areas experience America. And I think that that is something that's really prevalent in our politics. So I think that data point has sung for me in the month or so.
I mean, I feel like
the election.
I feel like it does everything you want a data point to do, right? It's like feels surprising, but also gets at something deeper. It's like sticky. You can repeat it. It's kind of like, I don't know. I really love it as a data point as well. Can I ask you one question about turnout though? Because maybe we should also add in that maybe the most surprising thing in turnout, in addition to how high it was that it was high on both sides, which I think we kind of talked about a fair amount on this show, but is another kind of sub data point in that, which has that element of like really stickiness.
Yeah, actually, when we were talking about like the best politicking of 2018, one thing I was going to bring up actually is, or I was going to ask whether Trump's use of immigration down the stretch run of the campaign should qualify for that.
For what?
Best politicking.
Best politicking. Yeah. It was on our list for worst, wasn't it?
Well,
but that might be, I mean, I think you're right, Micah. That's an interesting.
How so?
You could argue that the House was pretty lost and that
it's helped the Senate.
It helped in the Senate, and it drove up Republican turnout, while Democratic turnout was always going to be high. And so,
I don't think if you had asked someone in the White House, are you triaging the House or making matters worse in the House, frankly, to save the Senate? I mean, you could have defended that as a viable strategy. I don't think that's what their strategy was, and so therefore I'm not sure if we should reward the tactic that may have benefited a strategy they weren't pursuing.
Yeah, I certainly don't know whether it was a strategy.
Nate, do you have a nomination or winner for this most interesting data point of 2018?
I mean, I think the turnout. The other little dark horse is maybe the North Carolina election fraud data, where you kind of look at that and we're very used to like people making claims and saying, oh yeah, no, the Russians rigged Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and usually it doesn't really hold up. Whereas here you look at the numbers and you're like, that really doesn't make any sense. And some person or persons were involved in creating this result that doesn't make any sense in both the primary and the general election there. As a result, it looks like you're going to have a new election of some kind or another. So that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, just for the sake of we have his address so we can send him the award, we're going to give this to Dave Wasserman for his Whole Foods stat. So congratulations, Dave. You have the most interesting
data point
of 2018. Oh, it's enormous. It's like this three-tiered trophy. There's multiple soccer players at the top holding up other three-tiered trophies. It's quite a thing. We blew our entire budget on it. So that is the end of our award ceremony. Thank you to all the nominees. Your trophies are in the mail to the winners. We are going to take a quick break, and then we are going to talk about our 2019 political journalism resolutions. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Sunbasket. Sunbasket has been rated the number one meal kit by leading publications, and it is no wonder. They offer 18 weekly recipes with options for all sorts of diets like paleo, gluten-free, Mediterranean, lean and clean, vegan, and more. The bottom line, Sunbasket helps you eat healthier, simple as that. Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home. No matter how much experience you have in the kitchen, you will start making meals for yourself. There's nothing more satisfying than that. And you get more options than ever. Just go to the Sunbasket app and pick from those 18 weekly recipes. There's easy to cook dishes like Moroccan chicken with cauliflower rice and warm carrot salad. Sunbasket works with the best farms and suppliers to bring you fresh, organic produce and responsibly raised meats and seafood. There's something for everyone, so that you can be your kind of healthy. Go to sunbasket.com/politics today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/politics for $35 off. Once again, sunbasket.com/politics. All right, we're back. And for the last little bit of the show, we're going to do something we've done, as I said, for a few years now, which is look back at the year and then make some resolutions about the coming year. So this is something that we are resolving as political journalists to do moving forward. You can get snarky or you can get earnest, maybe lean towards the earnest side here. We're going to each go around and maybe name one and then react to it. And then we'll wrap this up. So, Nate, you want to start? What's your political resolution for 2019?
So this upcoming year of the four-year cycle is the most dangerous of the 4 years if you're a political prognosticator. The reason being that soon a lot of the attention will be in the Democratic primary, and it's not quite clear what like either a statistical or a good mental model of that ought to look like. It'll take a while before the polls become highly reliable. By 2020, then you can look at polls and you can count delegates and do all that math and stuff, right? But here the line between data journalism and punditry is a bit blurry, and I think, frankly, that's hard to avoid. But what I do want to tell myself after 2016 is not to get overly wedded toward one depiction or hypothesis about how the primary works, right? You know, I can imagine different conceptions in which Democrats are looking for the most non-Trump candidate or for the freshest face, for the most electable or whatever else, or different constituencies or different groups, or where the party decides or doesn't decide, or things are different or the same. I think you have to kind of balance all those together and say maybe there is like one set of characteristics by which Kamala Harris looks like the best nominee, and one by which Biden does, and one by which Beto does, or Klobuchar, or whatever else. And just like keeping a lot of those different hypotheses in mind and not getting overly committed.
That's a good resolution.
And I mean, I'll just tell listeners, for more on that, there is a how many word long essay from Nate about reflecting on the 2016 race and some of these pitfalls.
Very many words.
Very many words. But good. I mean, have you gone back out of curiosity and sort of read that and done some thinking about that?
Do you lovingly read your work back over a leisurely bottle of wine on a Friday?
I'm an editor now, so I don't write anymore. But when I was writing, I couldn't read my
work.
Yeah, I
can't read it.
It's horrible.
But have you done like any taking stock about what you did in 2015 and if 2019 is the equivalent?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it is like getting too wed to this like party decides hypothesis, or also just, again, like not like saying, okay, look, here's what I believe and why I believe it. But at the same time, Trump is ahead in the polls, and it's July, October, November, and maybe we have to give that some credit because we aren't that sure about how the primaries actually work. They're more complex than the general elections are in some ways. And so at some point, just like giving credit to some candidate who looks good by one set of criteria and not saying, oh, but that's not how it works. I mean, we don't really know how it works. We don't know that much.
Well, that's, and the key is like, this is why we make predictions. You know, in 2015, it was like the summer and Trump was leading the polls. And Nate said, listen, if he's leading, don't pay attention to polls until really like Thanksgiving around that time. And then I think our big mistake was not in saying in the summer not to take Trump seriously, but it was really after Thanksgiving where we should have said, mm-hmm. Okay, we set up this standard. Now let's revisit this. So, you know, I don't know. I've been thinking about how we cover 2020 and 2019, but part of me was thinking, oh, what if we just made a lot of like small predictions like that of like, here's a hypothesis for how the primary is working, and here's a prediction that will test that over the next month. You make a bunch of little ones like that. And then, you know, you mm-hmm. evaluate.
Claire, you got a resolution you want to throw out there?
Yeah. My resolution is to try to do stories that remember that politics is not just about a horse race and that it is a reflection of the way that people feel about their lives and their country. And so this goes back a little bit to what I was saying about the Times phone privacy story being a good use of data journalism to expand it to a wider audience. I think data journalism should be something that is consumed by a wider audience and not just by people who describe themselves as political junkies or things like that.
Like election nerds.
Yeah. Which actually are, you know, I understand that we all use them colloquially, but I sort of like hate those terms in part because they sort of gamify things that are very real to people. And so I guess my goal is to try to do stories that seek a wider audience and bring a wider audience to, you know, stories that might have a data hook or stories about politics. And suggestions welcome, listeners.
Micah?
I have sort of a boring one.
Okay.
My resolution is to read more in 2019.
Of a particular
Is that
kind?
A personal or professional?
No, it's a professional resolution. It's, I think, a stunning amount of political journalism. And I mean writing, I mean editing, I mean top to bottom, is done with like a good deal of ignorance. And so I think there's a ton of reporting and writing and commentary done without people having really dug into whatever issue they're writing or reporting or commenting on. And I, as a site, 538 tries to, this is one thing 538 tries to do better than other places is take more time, dig deeper. But as an editor, I feel like I could do a better job of digging into issues and really, really reading up on them and mastering stuff. It's not like my job is such that I have to master every subject in the world, right? There's like a limited number of things. And I feel like I could do a better job of doing that.
I'm going to throw one out there that I think builds on what you just said, which is I've just been trying to look to history a little more. I think that we do that on this podcast a fair amount. And often when you look to history, it does a really good job of offering you context and I think like lowering the temperature on stuff. You know, you get all heated and you look to history, it helps you give some context. But also I think looking to history sometimes helps you realize that what you're living in is big. And I think 2019 is going to be a pretty historic year. A lot of big stuff's going to happen. I will not be on this podcast to cover it, but I think there's going to be some big history with a capital H made in 2019. And I think looking to the past to give that a, yeah, that's how it's pronounced. Please pronounce that for what the entirety of the year.
What if nothing happens in 2019?
That would be, I would lose that bet. I think it's going to happen.
Something will happen.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, those are all very good resolutions. Listeners, keep us accountable to all of those as you continue to listen to the show and read the site. Okay, that is the end of the show. A programming note before we say goodbye. We're giving ourselves the day off on next Monday, New Year's Eve, but there will be a special something in this feed. So on New Year's Eve, refresh that feed and you'll have something to listen to. And then off to the races after that. And I wish the three of you and Galen and the entire team the best of luck. Thank you, Nate Silver.
Thank you, Jordy.
Thank you, Claire Malone.
Thanks, Jordy.
Thank you, Micah Cohen.
You're welcome.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. You're welcome. That was good. I almost blew right through that.
Right through it, yeah.
That's good. I like that. Keep this, Galen. My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Thanks again for listening. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. And we'll see you soon.